You've committed murder just as much as Elaine did. You killed a fly with a human head. She killed a human with a fly head. If she murdered, so did you.
On episode 29 of the Cut Print Film Podcast, we're abuzz about the fly. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave, and Chris.
Greetings, Earthlings. Welcome to the Cut Print Film Podcast, episode 29. I'm your only host, Chris Evangelist.
Woo!
Thanks, everyone.
Yeah!
I don't know what I'm doing here then, but my name's Jeff Rollins.
Woo, it's Jeff! Yeah! Woo!
Well, you're the soundboard guy, and Dave.
And I'm Dave Costel.
He's the news one in the booth who laughs.
Oh, all right.
Thanks, and that's our show.
All right. What are we doing today?
We're a movie podcast.
Who are we?
We are Cut Print Film, and we have a...
Woo, website. Yeah!
That'll never get old or tiresome.
We just thought we'd try a new thing.
Our website is cutprintfilm.com, where you can read all about a bunch of movie stuff.
Yes. Sometimes.
What's our tagline?
We don't have a tagline.
It was a perfect scream.
We review movies. We write editorials about movies. We do everything movie related except make movies, because we are talentless in that aspect.
Yeah, no thanks.
So today we're going to be talking about David Cronenberg's 1986 film The Fly in a little bit.
David Costelberg's.
Yeah, David Costelberger. Costelberger. It's two pieces of banana bread with pickles in between. It's terrible.
Banana bread.
Mm-mm. But what do you want to talk about first?
Well, let's talk about some current films,
because
we're getting slowly out of the dry season, and things that aren't total dreck are coming out now.
Yeah, I'd say this is the first week in almost a month where something decent came out
right.
that I was actually looking forward to.
Right.
We're going to have Gone Girl to talk about soon. That's fucking exciting.
Yes, in about 3 weeks.
Yeah. I thought it was closer.
Nope. Yeah. Sorry, Dave.
We'll cut that out and we'll edit it into a later episode.
We're going to have Star Wars to talk about in a few days. No, that's not until next year.
So what came out this week? Why don't you tell us?
Well, two films that I guess we could recommend are The Drop and also Honeymoon.
Mm-hmm.
So Honeymoon is a, it came out in theaters and it also came out on VOD, as they call it.
Yes.
And it's a horror film. It's an indie horror film. It's not, you know, there's not a lot of stars in it. It's a two-person show. It has Rose Leslie from Game of Thrones, and it has Harry Treadaway from Penny Dreadful.
Mm-hmm.
And they are a married couple, and they go on their honeymoon to a cabin in the woods, and creepy stuff happens.
Harry Treadaway was very good.
Yes,
like, they were both very good in this.
Yeah, yeah. But I've always known that she was good.
Right.
I didn't have much exposure to her.
This is the first time. I've never seen Penny Dreadful, and this, this is the first time I've ever seen him in action. And yeah, both of these actors are wonderful.
They carry the film because they have to. There's no one else around. So.
Coincidentally, Honeymoon is a film that derives a lot from The Fly, in terms of the metamorphosis.
Body horror, yeah.
But also like the slight changes that she starts going through, and it kind of mimics
without giving too much away.
Yeah. When she turns into
a baboon.
Yeah, when she turns into a Jeff Goldblum.
But it's Jeff Goldblum from Death Wish when he plays the mugger.
Yeah, where he spray paints a woman's ass.
He's just delightful in that film. What a scamp.
It's God actually created dinosaurs. Dinosaurs created man.
That's terrible.
You've got it twisted, Dave. You had too many Costelbergers.
Honeymoon, it's actually kind of similar to Antichrist, the Lars von Trier insane movie, because it has a similar premise where it's a couple, they go to a cabin, and the female of the couple turns out to be not what she seems. But this is a little tamer than Antichrist. There's no close-ups of penises getting smashed with rocks in this film.
Well, then count me out.
It's more accessible.
Yeah, more people can sit through this than Antichrist, which is only a movie for grandmas.
Yes. I think you're mistaken.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But Honeymoon does an amazing job at going back to classic horror that pulls terror from
the
environment and Yeah.
There is not a single jump scare in this movie, which is
it's so refreshing.
It's to be commended in this day and age where everyone just like everything is jump scares now.
Yeah, that bugs me about modern horror.
Because it's not fear, that's
it's
shocking.
It's startling.
Yeah,
it's not scary.
And you're just over it instantly.
I don't want to spoil Honeymoon, but I have things I want to say about it.
We can come back to it next year when Honeymoon 2 comes out. Honeymoon 2, The Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
I really liked the film, and if it had ended a little better, it could have like been
amazing.
I actually thought the last 10 minutes were a little weak, actually.
Really? There's,
not so much the content, just the way it was handled. It felt rushed.
Yeah, the one moment where
they shouldn't have been playing Limelight. I agree with you there. they rushed it.
They should have been I got nothing. It's too tough for me to talk about this without spoiling.
Yeah,
it.
So it's hard to go in cold and,
and bring a jacket.
I just felt like she didn't stick with the horror enough at the end when she could have.
Right.
It just kind of.
I disagree with you.
So perhaps you could, you at home could watch Honeymoon and then you could comment on the review and tell us what you thought of it.
Or don't.
Yeah, you probably won't do that.
What do you want from me? All right, so Honeymoon was good and I saw The Drop.
How was it?
The Drop was great.
How was that puppy? That's all I care about.
Puppy was adorable.
Oh man, that puppy.
Spoiler, he wants to name the puppy Mike.
Oh.
But Noomi Rapace will not allow that.
What a bitch.
Yeah, so
that's the plot.
My thoughts exactly.
The whole plot of the movie.
So she names it Prometheus instead.
Incorrect. The Drop stars
the Ludens Drop. That was
the original name. The Ludens candy disguised as a cough drop that does nothing for you medicinally.
They couldn't get the rights though, so they just shortened the title.
The Drop stars Tom Hardy and James Gandolfini and Noomi Rapace. I'm saying her name right. I hope.
Is that it?
It's
Rapace?
It's Rape Ace, I believe.
I don't believe that for one second, sir.
I could be wrong, but.
And it basically the premise is that James Gandolfini used to run a crew of gangsters, and this Chechen mob moved in, and they said, "We want your bar," because he ran a bar, and he flinched, and
the Bada Bing.
Yeah, it was not the Bing.
Yeah, it was the Roadhouse from the film Roadhouse.
It was more like the Roadhouse than the Bing. So now the Chechens run the bar, but he's the face of the bar, and they use the bar as a drop point for. All the money that the mob makes throughout a night, but they use it as a random drop point. It's not every night. And the bar gets robbed of a couple grand and the mob
droppings.
Yeah, robbed of the bird droppings and the mobsters want the money back. And it takes off from there and it snowballs. And there's a side plot that is interesting.
Okay.
The whole cast is fantastic for the most part.
How's Gandolfini? Because this is his last role.
It's his final complete role.
Right.
And I was worried about that going. I didn't know that going in. Right. I thought maybe, they'll probably have to write him out 10 minutes in because who knows if he filmed.
Oh, he went on vacation.
But yeah, it's a full character, full arc, and he's amazing in this movie, and so is Tom Hardy. Tom Hardy is outstanding. Outstanding in this.
I love Tom Hardy. He is a good actor. I mean,
he gives such a just this nuanced performance, but it's so reserved and subtle.
Right.
And there's more to this character than he lets on to other people in the film, and it's fantastic.
Oh, like when at the end you find out he was the one in the Lazarus pit with Talia, right?
Exactly.
He was the guy who saved Talia.
Exactly.
Okay.
Talia's
what they named the pit bull.
That's the twist.
One of the critics that I was chatting with was saying that Tom Hardy does a bad accent in the film. Is that way off base?
It's an exaggerated Brooklyn accent. This film takes place in Brooklyn, but it might as well be Boston because it's by the writer of
Mystic River.
Yeah, Mystic River, Gone Baby Gone.
I just make that up?
What?
Did he write The Town?
No, he didn't.
No.
Oh, okay.
But all his stories take place in Boston, and this is actually a short story kind of stretched to feature length. So it suffers a little bit as a result of that.
Like, do they use Drop It Like It's Hot at all in
all the
soundtrack?
Time. No, it's like a music bed.
How about that Drop and Loads clip from the Howard Stern show? Do they just play that every few seconds?
Yeah, it seemed very out of place.
They don't even explain where it's coming from. You just hear it.
But it's getting good reviews. I really enjoyed it.
It's a weird release, like that it can't, because like this is sounding like the dead season. It's kind of weird that they just released it now. It felt like they sort of just like, whatever, here's a movie.
Yeah, I don't think they knew what to do with it. It's probably not going to win many awards, right, unless somebody gives Gandolfini a posthumous award.
Like a sympathy.
Unless the rest of the year is just horrible.
Yeah, right. Which is possible, because, man, it's possible. It's a bad year.
But I don't know. I don't think it's better than Blue Ruin.
No.
But it is a good movie. Definitely worth seeing.
I definitely want to see it, mostly for the puppy.
I saw Eleanor Rigby this week, but spoiler, I'm going to recommend that, so I'll talk about it later.
Well, at least you told everybody at the top of the show.
That's all right. We'll all forget by the time that happens, 3 hours from now.
All right, so David Cronenberg.
Yeah.
He's that guy. He's part of our director series.
Now that you mention that, let me hit this.
Director series.
That's it. I think that's enough. They've heard enough.
Oh, man.
I never get tired of Jeff angrily ending it at the end there. That gets
me every single time. That's enough. It's still going, by the way.
It'll keep going.
It goes the entire show. You just can't hear it.
So after Videodrome, Cronenberg directed The Dead Zone.
Yes.
And then took a few years off because he got held up in Total Recall production.
Yeah, in Total Recallville.
Yeah.
And then
Making that great Colin Farrell version.
Yeah.
He traveled
to the future to make that film.
Whew.
That was one of those movies that, this is off base, but that, like, one of the first movies where it's like, Bryan Cranston's going to be in a movie.
Yeah, everybody's like, excited.
Oh, that didn't work out.
We see it and we're like, this is horrendous. What a terrible movie that Total Recall.
Well, they shouldn't have cast Bryan Cranston as the female lead in the movie.
I agree.
It was just distracting.
He only has two nipples. I don't understand.
He's doing an Arnold impression the whole time.
Getting a pump.
Go Hagen. Anyway, so then he goes on to make The Fly in 1986.
Which is his biggest commercial hit.
Yeah.
Which is, it's kind of remarkable that this film is his biggest hit.
And this was a hit instantly.
Anyway, it was a huge hit. And because it's such a dark, violent movie. It's not really a mainstream film, but this is as mainstream as Cronenberg gets pretty much at this point.
Yeah, it's like, it weirdly is mainstream now, though. Like, this made it that kind of movie.
Right.
More, I don't know, Aliens, it's kind of like in the same tone as that.
I would say that, but I think this is a little weirder than Aliens.
It's definitely weirder.
Because like Aliens, you can always shrug off all the weirdness by saying like, oh, it's in the future and they're in space.
That's true.
This is in modern day for the time it was made and on Earth. So it's like, oh, this is all happening and it's weird.
Yeah, you said Cronenberg was tied up with Total Recall, and they originally went with, for the director, Robert Bierman.
Oh, he's my favorite. No, he is.
Well, he directed a film that I recommended early in this show's existence, the Nicolas Cage vehicle, Vampire's Kiss.
Oh, wow.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. But his daughter was killed in South Africa during pre-production. And
so they gave him some time off. Mel Brooks actually is the executive producer of this.
Yes, he is.
Mel Brooks gave him a few months off, and then he went back to him and he said, do you want to make The Fly? And the
Absolutely
guy was like,
not.
No, I'm still sad.
I've lost my passion for this movie. So they ended up getting Cronenberg.
Yeah, and thank God they did. Yeah. Not thank God that guy's daughter died. That's terrible. But thank God Cronenberg directed this.
I would be interested in seeing what movie this would have been had Robert Bierman directed it, because I really do love Vampire's Kiss.
The issue is that Cronenberg essentially rewrote the script from scratch.
He kept a lot in there.
A lot of the names were changed and some of the plot elements.
He kept a lot from the draft that was written before he came on.
And he also insisted that they leave the original writer of the screenplay on the screenplay,
right.
So he has co-writing credit.
Cohagen.
Cohagen? No, Charles Pogue is the man's name.
Yeah.
He's the lead singer of the Pogues.
Yes. Well, we have really gone off course.
Am I wrong of that? No?
Irish band, the Pogues.
But I read that the script is very different, the original script. And he...
Well, there's
the really only the elements he kept were the fingernails and stuff like that, like little story elements.
I mean, the outline is pretty much the same. In the original draft,
to a fly.
In the original draft, they were actually a married couple.
Mm-hmm.
And
him and the fly?
Yeah, the fly and Jeff Goldblum were married. And they had
very progressive.
Yeah, it was a different kind of film. And there were two other male characters who were sort of villainous that they sort of combined into Stathis Baranian or whatever his name is in the movie. What's his name in the film?
The Iron Throne is mine. Yeah, right.
Renly Baratheon, I believe.
Yeah.
So you want me to go through a plot synopsis?
Let's get a big synopsis going here. Let's get a big deep dish pizza going as well.
Mm-mm. Pass the soda. Are we going to do this the whole time? All right.
Oh, that's haunting. Please
Seth
don't.
Brundle, played by Jeff Goldblum, a brilliant but eccentric scientist, meets Veronica Queef.
Veronica Mars.
Played by... No, not Veronica
Veronica
Mars.
Queef.
No, not Veronica
I'll
Queef
stop, I'll
either.
Stop now. I'll stop now.
Veronica Queef, played by Gina Davis, a journalist for Particle Magazine, at a Meet the Press event held by Bartok Science Industries, the company that provides funding for Brundle's work. Seth takes her back to the warehouse that serves him as both home and lab and shows her a project that will change the world, a set of telepods that allow instantaneous teleportation. Brundle convinces Veronica to keep the project's existence quiet in exchange for exclusive rights to the story. Although the telepods can transport inanimate objects, they do not work properly on living things, as is demonstrated when a live baboon is turned inside out during an experiment.
Just casually.
In a horrendous scene.
It's great.
Terrible scene. Seth and Veronica soon begin a romantic relationship. Brundle plans a romantic evening with her, but she suddenly departs before they can celebrate. His judgment soon becomes impaired by alcohol and the paranoid fear that she is secretly rekindling a relationship with her editor and former lover, Stathis Barans.
Baranathian.
Played by John Getz. Brundle hastily decides to teleport himself, which is, you know, what I would do in that situation. Yeah.
I don't know why he waited that long, honestly.
Unaware that a common housefly has slipped into the transmitter pod with him.
Motherfucker.
Although he comes out the other end seemingly normal, eventually he exhibits what appears to be beneficial and purifying effects.
Like underwear gymnastics.
That's right. Such as increased strength, stamina, and sexual potency.
He conveniently has a Olympic-style bar in his apartment.
Well, what do you think his daughter in Jurassic Park 2 in those boots?
They cut you from the team?
Veronica, however, is more concerned about Brundle's growing mania, as well as the strange bristly hairs growing out the wound of his back.
That's what my wife's concerned about with me.
But nobody else seems concerned about that hair growing out of that wound.
Just her.
Brundle soon realizes that something went horribly wrong during his teleportation when his fingernails begin falling off.
And goo and really, shoots out of them.
Who wouldn't figure out something went wrong when your fingernails fall off?
That's your first sign that something's wrong right there.
He checks his computer's records and discovers that the telepod computer, confused by the presence of two separate life forms in the sending pod, merged him with the fly at the molecular genetic level.
Wah, wah.
Oh, poor Seth.
All he needed was a line of code. That's Don't right. merge to... come on.
Yeah.
He needed an if-then line.
He needed like carrot, don't insert fly, end carrot.
Over the next 4 weeks, Brundle continues to deteriorate, losing various body parts and becoming progressively less human in appearance.
And it's disgusting.
Oh. He eventually reaches out to Veronica and theorizes that he is slowly becoming a hybrid creature that is neither human nor insect, which he dubs the Brundle Fly.
I love it.
Brundle soon starts to exhibit fly-like characteristics, such as vomiting digestive enzymes onto his food in order to dissolve it, and the ability to cling to walls and ceilings. He realizes he is losing his human reason and compassion, and he's now being driven by a primitive impulse that he cannot control. Veronica learns she is pregnant by Seth, and she cannot be sure if it was conceived before or after his fly transformation. So she decides to get an abortion.
After having the worst nightmare
in
the history of nightmares.
Horrendous.
Maggot worm, baby.
Yeah. We'll come back to that.
She goes to Stathis Barans.
Every time.
I can't help myself.
Every time. Stathis Baratheon.
She goes to Stathis Barans to persuade him to have abortion doctor Barry Convex.
I love that. I loved his reemergence.
Take the fly.
I'm pretty sure he's wearing the same suit he
Probably.
Wore as he was Barry Convex as well.
Meanwhile, Brundle abducts her and takes her back to his lab. He tries to convince her to have the baby, but she says that she can't. So he comes up with a rational plan to merge the three of them, him, her, and their baby together with a third pod.
It was the prototype.
Yeah, prototype pod. And so Stathis Barans, anybody?
No.
All right, we're
Joffrey
done.
Baratheon.
comes to the rescue with a shotgun, and Brundle teleports himself into another telepod?
Well, what happens is...
Brundle thing.
Brundlefly.
He becomes Brundlepod.
Stathis Baranian shoots the wire.
Yes.
And he disconnects
Veronica.
And so Brundlefly tries to break out of the pod, and the door is half open. Half open, and the transport begins.
Yeah, so he's fused together now with
the door.
Transport pod and a cable.
Right.
And he begs Veronica to kill her, kill him.
As would anyone.
And puts the shotgun to his own head.
And she for a moment, she's like, oh, I can't, because I guess she was considering maybe getting back together with him.
Well, he is a good kisser.
But then she blows his head off.
And that's it.
And the movie ends, and we're all sad.
No one's happy.
He's
no one feels
cute
good.
At the end there, though.
What's that? Oh, yeah, he looks like E.T. He looks like Johnny Five from Short Circuit.
It's a sad puppy alien fly thing.
So we got a lot to talk about here. Where should we begin?
Well,
let's start at the end and go backwards to the beginning.
Yes.
I say we start in the middle, then do the beginning, then the end.
As much as we can get it convoluted, that's the way I want to
do it. I say we start with The Fly 2 with Eric Stoltz and then go back to...
Perfect.
But seriously, folks.
We got a million of them.
Nah, I only have a few.
Mm. All right, so right off the bat, I will say this film made me miss Gina Davis in movies. Because
what happened to Gina?
She is so good in this. And it's like you forget how good she is as an actress.
She made that... TV show edit, what was it, a Commander in Chief, and then she disappeared.
Oh, I forgot about that.
She played the female president. Like, that was some crazy wild idea.
Yeah.
That was the whole premise. Like, look how wacky this show is.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's gone from movies now.
She was great in this.
Gina Davis once had a career, and there was a reason. She was excellent.
Yeah,
I mean, she doesn't look crazy in her old age, so I don't know why she wouldn't be acting.
I don't know if she had kids and retired or what, but she actually got the job because she was dating Goldblum.
And they have great chemistry.
Awesome chemistry.
They're great together. They're both very tall people, so that works in their face.
I have in my notes that this is the tallest, skinniest sex I've ever seen. Ever.
How about...
There's a whole lot of Goldblum in this movie, so...
Let's start with Goldblum, then.
Who is also fantastic in this.
Oh, my God. He's just in the... Like, I first started the movie up, and the movie doesn't... prep you for itself at all. You
know, because the opening music is nearly identical to the 1958 Fly music.
Oh, is it?
Nearly identical.
That.
There's the trumpets and horns, and it's got that authentic retro horror, that sound that is very familiar to anybody that watches the Universal movies.
Yes.
I'm not too crazy about the music in this, but we'll get to that.
Oh, really?
To that, I'm sure you guys will bring up the music at one point.
We will. We'll get back to
anyway,
it.
Anyway, so...
It
throws you right into this, like, sci-fi... Not sci-fi, like, science convention.
Oh, it dives headfirst into the plot. Yeah. We're ready to go into
the
plot immediately.
And they're at WizardCon, I guess, where they're at. And and Jeff Goldblum, he's really just trying to pick her up, because, like...
Uh-huh.
He hedges it with like, oh, I'm creating a great invention, but later when she tries to write about the invention, he's like, oh no, don't write about it, which means he's really just trying to get laid, basically.
Right. And he tries to pick her up by bragging that he has a cappuccino maker, which is such an 80s, early 90s thing that, like, remember home cappuccino makers were $2,000,
yes.
And they were like a very ritzy thing to have.
So
he's clearly picking
immediately
her up.
His acting skills are just like off the charts, though, because he comes off as this super weirdo creep.
Yeah, he's
eyes are darting all over the place, like, and he just creeps you out.
He's got these idiosyncrasies that...
Jeff Goldblum, he's one of those actors who's sort of fallen into, like, the Samuel L. Jackson territory, where he's, like, sort of a parody of himself at this point, and it's easy to forget that he's actually a great actor. It's the same thing with Samuel L. Jackson. It's easy to forget, like, oh, he's actually a really good actor.
As much as I liked him, Goldblum, in this movie, I prefer him as a... character on the margins of a film. I don't really like him as a main character.
Really?
Usually. Not that I didn't enjoy him in this. Yeah. I thought he was great in this, but I think he's
a bundle of ticks.
He's so niche, you know what I mean?
Can you think of anything else where he was the center of it?
Yeah, Jurassic Park 2.
Oh, well. Anything good?
No.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But I think this is a movie that plays to his strengths. Like, I can't imagine anyone else in this role in this film. He's perfect for it. And it's interesting to watch how it develops, because even though in the first half of the movie he has those Goldblum-isms, and he does a lot of stuff. He does a lot of talking with his hands. And
the eyes. He's widening his eyes. As
after
he talks.
After
also, the magic word is cheeseburger.
after he becomes Brundlefly, he starts changing. He still has those tics, but they're so accelerated.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting to watch him like take those to like the nth degree, where he's just like constantly like motor mouthed. And
it's odd. The studio did not want Goldblum.
Who did they want?
I don't know. Yeah, they didn't want him.
Yeah.
But Cronenberg demanded it, and they
like,
trusted him.
The only other person I can think of who fits in with like that weird accent would be like Michael Keaton, I guess. Like
Keaton would have been excellent in this, I think.
Maybe like Willem Dafoe.
That actually would be interesting because he's so weird too.
Yeah.
You definitely need an eccentric actor, and that's why I think Goldblum works in this role. And we talked about Gina Davis, who's just phenomenal.
She's very good in this.
But
Goldblum is like, I don't even know how to explain it. This is without a doubt his best role.
Yeah.
I would say
also his most
prominent,
iconic role.
Yeah,
but it's cool. Like, there's cool things in the script where before he turns into the fly, he's still doing weird. Like you were saying, those weird Jeff Goldblum things. But he's doing like weird fly-like things before.
Well, where
he even
plays a piano for no reason.
I love it. Just like, look at how great I am at piano.
Mostly just with his eyes, where he's doing the fly eyes. A
lot
like,
of eye like, acting.
Yeah, and it seems intentional that they're like, this is the guy who's going to turn into the fly.
In case you weren't aware, it's not Gina Davis, it's him.
I really, really, really like John Getz in this.
He's great. I like how in the movie begins, you assume he's just like, oh, he's like the prick other guy.
And boy, is he a fucking prick.
Right.
I have in my notes that this guy is reprehensible, and I hate, he's a manipulative piece of garbage.
But like by the end of the movie, you sort of like see, you like him. Like,
yeah, he becomes the hero.
What I would say about this movie is this is like David Cronenberg's version of a romantic comedy. That's what is.
It's absolutely.
Like, first and foremost, this is like a romance movie. It's really just like someone meeting someone new, and they turn out to not be the person you want them to be, and it turns out your old boyfriend is who you want to be. That's what this is. It just happens to involve a man becoming a monster.
And Goldblum said himself that he went method for the role,
right.
And because he and Gina Davis were dating, that he actually made John Getz uncomfortable about the fact that his character supposedly had a sexual relationship with Davis. So any scene between Davis and Getz, there was this like weird tension because he knew Goldblum was watching
standing
on
right
the
off
set.
Camera. Like.
So, and you can see it. Once you know that, if you go back and watch it, you can see it.
That's
like in their body language.
That's neat. Yeah.
What the fuck? I wasn't crazy about him.
Really?
Yes. Really?
I don't know why.
Stannis Baratheon, you weren't down with him?
I read that in an original version of the script, they're supposed to end up married together.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, wisely, they don't have happen in this, because that just seems stupid.
Right.
Because the, like you were saying, how he goes from villain to hero, it's a weird thing for a movie, especially in the 80s. Like, and test audiences didn't respond well to them getting back together in the end. Because it's like, wait, we hate that guy.
Yeah.
Which is also the reason they cut the monkey scene, because it's like,
you're talking, there's a second monkey scene.
Yeah, there's a scene where that's cut out of the film, where Brundle, in his attempt to try and find a cure, he splices a cat and a monkey together, and it becomes a cat
two-headed creature.
And it's horrifying.
And it like in the beginning of the movie, the monkey that he transports successfully, I guess, jumps on him and hugs him.
Yeah.
And this, the goddamn cat creature jumps on him, but attacks him,
and he beats it to death.
With a pipe.
And so, test audiences were like, "Please cut that, because it makes us hate Jeff Goldblum."
And that's left over from the original script,
right?
That scene.
Oh, it was.
Yeah, that was in the original script.
There's a thing actually in the original movie where the scientist sends like a cat through his machine, and the cat doesn't like reappear.
But
like,
you can hear it meowing through the air.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of fucking creepy.
Yeah.
I wish they would have kept that in.
The original 1958 movie is excellent, by the way. But back
Was that in the 58 movie?
The cat, yeah.
It doesn't get spliced with a monkey, but
it just disappears and you can hear it meowing away
into that space. That really brings us to the practical effects, which are fucking incredible in this movie.
So good.
Yeah.
They're even better than Videodrome. And Videodrome has great effects.
Well,
but
different team.
Different team, yeah. And I actually think Rick Baker's a better makeup guy. But
he is.
But these are phenomenal.
This was the effects were done by Chris Wallace,
nice.
Who did Gremlins.
Yeah.
And specifically the face-melting scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Nice.
Yeah. So
Now that you say that, I can totally picture that when Stath Baranian's hand is melting at the end, because it's that same sort of like color of blood.
His ankle.
Yeah.
So yeah, he was hesitant on working on this film because he doesn't like doing remakes.
Right.
But once he read Cronenberg's rewrite of the script, he was all in.
Cronenberg has a little cameo.
He does. I missed it.
He's the doctor in the dream sequence who delivers the maggot baby.
Yeah.
I totally missed it.
Yeah.
And it's like a complete nod to Dead Ringers because he's wearing like the same gynecologist get-up with the glasses. It's like, it's kind of cool that he threw that in there.
But the makeup is
unbelievable,
astoundingly good, because there's a lot of it in this movie. Basically, through the last half of the movie, every time we see Jeff Goldblum, every different scene, he's wearing a different amount of makeup because he's transforming through the entire second half of the movie.
And it's
always like believable.
It's still visibly Jeff Goldblum too, which is wonderful. You can see that he's in agony.
Right.
Like, that really comes through.
It just looks
because you can still see his features. Yeah. This grotesquery. Yeah,
the crazy thing is that monkey cat scene we were just talking about has a transitional phase in it
that is not
in the movie, and it's one of the like most striking phases. Like he looks the most grotesque, I would say. Not the final version, which is insanely crazy looking. Yeah. But
what I loved about just the monster look in general, the flat, is that I love that it doesn't look straight up like a fly. Like
no, it's
in the original, like his head is like a fly head. It's like a giant fly head, which for the time is shocking.
Me too.
But I love that it's like this hybrid creature, and like it's both the makeup and Goldblum's performance. It just looks so just painful to function, just to become this like horrible looking deformed.
Yeah,
like he can't like walk right. At the very end where he becomes like the full on fly. I love that design where it's just like constant, like the face is constantly twitching and the eyes are constantly moving.
Right. And the original script had him actually turn into a giant fly,
which would be ridiculous.
Awful, awful. And which is Cronenberg was completely uninterested in doing anything like the original movie where a fucking fly's head gets put on a human's body, and a human's head gets put on a fly body.
Right.
In fact, there's a story about Vincent Price not being able to get through his line
in the reading original.
About you killed a fly with a human head. Like, apparently that took 100 takes to get through because you could not say it with a straight face.
This is utter bullshit. I'm not reading this, Drek.
But yeah,
dub it, goddammit.
These effects look so different from Videodrome and even anything Rick Baker ever did.
It's a lot more organic because the Videodrome effects, they were supposed to be sort of this combination of like machine and the flesh.
And this is,
which comes back big time.
Which you even get in this film. You get
at the end. Flesh. But earlier it's supposed to look more like organic material.
Right.
Nope.
And it does. I mean,
it just looks like horribly cancerous, tumorous flesh.
Oh, what's that?
And he's
he lifts up his shirt.
And Goldblum, he starts keeping like in his medicine cabinet all his discarded
the Brundle
Natural History Museum.
Yeah.
Where he just like he opens it, like you can see like his penis is in a jar. All this stuff. It's just horrible.
Where else would you put your penis?
Absolutely.
In the medicine cabinet.
No matter how many times you see the fly, you will forget how grotesque. And
this movie is absolutely disgusting.
This is like it's a gross movie.
When his tooth just falls out onto the keyboard,
he's biting a pencil and just like,
I started screaming laughing.
Even like the first thing that happens, like
when he pops his fingernail off and pus comes out, like it's a pimple.
His nail comes off and he squeezes his finger and pus just shoots onto his mirror and it's like, And it's gross, but it's also like darkly humorous. There's a great scene that just, from beginning, it's just funny as hell. Basically, Gina Davis shows up at the apartment, and it's the first time she's seen him when he's just all mutated. And he's going to eat a donut. And so flies, they can't digest solid food, so they spit up this, it's called vomit drop, onto their food, and it disintegrates it. And then they slurp that up. So without any like thought, he just picks up a donut and just barfs on it. And she just looks horrified. He goes, "Oh, that's disgusting." And then But then, as if that wasn't funny enough, he goes to, like, touch his ear, and his ear just fucking falls off, and he goes, "My ear!" And it's just, it's hilarious. It's, yeah, it's so funny.
It's absolutely played for both, it's successfully played for both horror and laugh.
Right.
It works both ways.
It's supposed to be disturbing, but it's also, you can tell it's clearly supposed to be just darkly funny.
And that's a rare feat to be able to accomplish, playing something simultaneously for horror and laughs and achieving both.
What's great,
nearly impossible.
Well, on the commentary, Cronenberg points this out too. What Tess audience has reacted the most to that scene is after his ear falls off and he's like, he says, "Help me," and she hugs him and she presses her face against the side of his face where the ear just came off.
Yeah.
And Cronenberg said, like, Tess audiences, like, screamed as just, like, in joy and, like, terror in that. Because she's pressing her face against this, like, gooey mass where his ear once was.
I was going to say, she won't stop fucking hugging him. And, like, it's a genius way to make the audience
very
feel empathetic, like, at the same time. Like, you're Gina Davis if you're watching it. So every time she hugs him, you're like, "Oh, fuck, I wouldn't hug that guy."
Exactly. And that brings us to where she tears his jaw off.
Oh, that
which instigates the final transformation to where he actually turns into
the final countdown?
Yeah. No, not the final countdown. Incorrect.
Which is just like, it's nonstop horror. Like, his legs, he clearly skipped leg day because his skin just oozes off. Just like,
it's horrifying.
And then, like, his face melts. And what I love about this effect is, as his face is falling off, you see his human eyes just, like, liquefy and, like, run down his cheeks. It's just, it's great.
And what they did with this effect, I think it's fantastic. There's a quote by Chris Wallace that said, he was talking about how they used to use an inflatable bladder for the American Werewolf in London effects that were so, you know, acclaimed.
A whoopee cushion?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, like on Videodrome. They brought back the Videodrome whoopee cushion.
So, you know, when the werewolf's face is elongating, it's a bladder that they inflated with air. And everybody knew how they did that at this point. And his quote was, "If the housewives know about the technique, we've got to do something else." And so they did. And what they did was they took these spring-loaded plates and they put it inside this giant Jeff Goldblum-type latex head. And they slowly, you know,
cranked it
outward from the inside out, and then the head would come apart, and they had to shoot it from an angle so that it still, because this was a giant head, but it was still supposed to look like Jeff Goldblum's head. So they shot it from an angle so that it looked like it was real, and his head just comes apart, and then it reveals, you know, the Johnny Five.
Yeah, the Johnny Five fly.
They called it the space bug on set.
That's an interesting quote, the housewives thing.
Yeah.
And it kind of goes back to what we were talking about before with the like CG, how it doesn't, like, you know how they do
it. Yeah, there's nothing.
So it's
there's
not
no,
never amazing.
There's no magic. Like, if they remade this movie, which I'm sure they will someday, and it'll be terrible.
Yeah.
It would just all be CGI, and it's like, "Oh, I know how they did that. It was a bunch of nerds in a computer lab." So do you want to take a break, and we'll come back and talk about more about this big. The film is a big, in general, metaphor for just disease.
Yeah.
And loving someone who has a disease.
So talk about some themes.
Yeah.
Talk like about the flea.
Like the Indiana Jones theme. I love that.
Talk about the pest starring John Leguizamo.
And we'll get in touch with that Howard Shore soundtrack.
We'll get in touch with Howard Shore. He's going to call in. I hear you didn't like my score, Dave. Go fuck yourself.
I'm sorry.
"I'll bet you're itching to raid the kitchen. But please don't go. There's still more show."
Here at Cutprint Film, we do our very best to keep you in tune with the movie industry. We're revolutionizing the way you read movie reviews by putting them on the internet. Go to cutprintfilm.com and we will guarantee you a pleasant experience. We're breaking new ground every day to bring you the finest material possible. We've partnered with such clients as morelikeradio.com, antifanboy.com, and Joystick Jerks, the podcast. So check out all of that and more on cutprintfilm.com. And remember, have a Cutprint Film day.
Welcome back, everyone.
With the moon
drinking Crown Royal right out of the bottle. With a straw, though. We don't want to get germs on each other's lips.
You know what this song needs?
I don't know. Why don't you tell me? Oh, there he is.
Oh, Superfly.
Yeah, Superfly. Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff Goldblum is Superfly.
He has a super mane of hair in this.
Oh, there's a lot of big hair. Him and Gina Davis, they have a whole lion between them, I think, with their hair.
Okay, Superfly, we heard enough of you.
That's enough of you. That was the great Curtis Mayfield. Yeah.
In studio today.
replacing Robert Loggia.
That's our janitor who also sings.
All right, so what are we getting into now?
Well, let's talk about... We're going to talk about the themes of the film also, yeah. And how it deals with disease and just people reacting.
The theme
disease.
Park?
Yeah, we're going to talk the fly theme park. What could go wrong?
I would like to point out this is an interesting movie.
It sure is. All right. Sorry.
Well said, everybody.
This is, I tried wording this intellectually, a stationary film about transportation.
Go ahead. Repeat that, please.
It's a stationary film about transportation. The whole film takes place in essentially the same room.
Right.
All
right.
That's an interesting observation.
Well, I mean,
I'll give you that, but only once.
Okay.
One of the biggest reasons Goldblum's character wants to invent this is because he gets travel sick.
I fucking love that.
He
by
gets
the
car
way.
Sick. Every sort of motion makes him sick. So, it's kind of neat. It's kind of a funny like.
It's also a fully realized plot device.
Yeah. And it gives that character like more depth. Like he's not.
Yeah.
Obviously,
nothing's by accident. Nothing's done just to do it in this film.
Like I love that. Obviously, he wants to create this for like
scientific purposes.
Yeah, the notary. But he also just has like a selfish reason. He's like, oh, I don't want to fly. So
I just love car sick Jeff Goldblum.
Right.
Just
grabbing his stomach.
That's one of those moments where. Goldblum doesn't really work for me when he's doing stuff like that. But, for the most part, I liked him in this film. You were talking about themes.
Yeah.
And Chris mentioned that it's pretty disease. Much about disease, right, this whole film.
When this came out, a lot of people saw it as like an allegory for the AIDS epidemic, which was
exploding
at that time. And Cronenberg said like it wasn't specifically about that, but you could obviously interpret it.
Yeah, he said if you... or someone you know has AIDS, then the fact that you're going to see AIDS in this movie is, expected.
But right. Just like
but it's an allegory for all disease.
Yeah. Just like he was saying, like when he wrote it, he was more interested in just disease and death, which is pretty much something we all have to deal with. And just it's true. Like if someone in your life gets like a fatal disease, it does change them just in multiple ways.
Yeah, both physically, mentally, emotionally.
Yeah.
Across the board, which happens to Seth Brundle.
Right. Seth Goldblum, you were going to say, weren't you?
Yes.
they become...
Jeff Brundle.
Seth Rogen.
Well, I don't know. You're taking it too far, sir.
The person becomes detached, and then Goldblum is like literally becoming detached from himself.
Right, and
body.
He knows it, too. He verbalizes that to... Veronica.
And it's almost like he's going through like the stages of grief. It's like denial and like bargaining.
Oh, that's
and,
interesting.
And anger and stuff like that.
You're physically seeing this creature manifest these stages of grief.
Because like
that's interesting.
Once when he first goes through it, he's like, this has made me great. I'm a better person. He's doing like crazy gymnastics. And
he's doing the CrossFit workout of the day in his undies.
I love that where he's just like flipping on that and he's like running on the ceiling, like slapping his feet on the ceiling as he does the flips.
Yeah.
I also love that because he comes down off the pole and Gina Davis like comes over and you can just tell she's like, we have to fuck right now. You can just tell like she just, her panties are drenched from him just flipping, doing those
gymnastics bar.
Just like the look she gives him because like he comes off that bar and he's like, his torso is like glistening, and she's just like, "Oh yeah, we're gonna bone.
Let's do this."
Like, yeah, I want you inside me right now.
And boy, he just can't stop having sex.
Yeah, I guess flies love sex because this guy, he can't stop.
He's a goer.
Yeah.
This could also be seen as like a parallel to the cocaine epidemic of the 80s.
Right.
That's true too, because he definitely is sped up.
That
on something.
Fucking scene where he can't stop putting sugar in his coffee.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's actually a very horrifying scene because you're watching this man fall apart, but
without
he doesn't realize it yet.
Yeah.
And it, again, it's like it's humorous, but then you, when you realize what he's turning into, it's like, oh, it's not really that funny because he's screwed, basically.
Yeah. So for he and Veronica, you know, they have words and.
And he goes out and he picks up a girl with even bigger hair.
Well, yeah, but if, how does he do it?
He does it with
his, he wins her honor the old-fashioned way.
Arm wrestling. It's hard to pick like a favorite scene in this movie because I love so many. But this is probably one of my top scenes of this movie where basically he's at a bar. There's some guys. There's some big burly men. They're arm wrestling.
Doing what guys do at bars. The arm wrestle one another.
And so Goldblum's there. He's wearing a leather bomber jacket and
no shirt on.
He's eating a chocolate bar.
Fucking leather jacket, no shirt. Yeah. He's like the fucking Fonz.
And he looks horrendous, by the way. Yeah. He looks like...
His face is just covered
he smells.
Yeah.
Well, Veronica and says, later, you smell
like,
terrible.
She's like, oh, you look bad, you smell bad. And so he says, like, there's a girl at the bar and there's two men.
Nancy Allen from Blowout is there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah.
Not really.
Nah.
But, yeah, and he says, basically, dead. He's like, I bet you $100. I bet you $100 I can take both of you. And he's like, oh, I get to take the woman home because you could buy women in bars back then.
Well, no, he's not buying them. He's winning her honor with an arm wrestling match.
Right, yeah. Well, that's how I met my wife, too. So.
But you said you met her the other ways that you've said before.
Oh, like OkCupid? Yeah, OkCupid, but first it was the arm wrestling contest. But anyway, so he challenges this man to the arm wrestling. And he grabs his arm, his hand, and his secretions come out of his hands, and he snaps this guy's wrist. Oof. And this man makes the worst. He's just like, ah!
Yeah, it's a brutal, disgusting scene.
It's shocking because like it's like a compound fracture. His bone pops out of his wrist.
It is an awful scene, yeah. But a fantastic scene at the same time.
Right, and then he takes this woman home. Well, they go to a bunch of bars first.
Yeah, they bar hop till 9:30 a.m. Yeah.
Who wouldn't go bar hopping?
The sun's in the middle of the sky by the time they get home.
Who wouldn't go bar hopping with a bomber jacket shirtless man who just snapped her wrist?
He brings her back to the fly cave.
No shirt, no shoes, no problem.
Yeah. So yeah, they go bar hopping. Then he carries her up a bunch of flight of stairs, and then they have it's like a brunch fuck session because they come out when the
some
morning.
ATM.
Yeah. And he keeps going through the pods for some reason. I don't know why he's doing that.
He loves it. He can't get enough. Well, he thinks that it's purifying him and strengthening him when really it's not doing anything now. He's already doomed.
Which proves that like his thing actually works correctly.
Yeah.
Because he never like gets like.
I actually wanted to bring up, going back to earlier with the cat thing from the original movie, in the short story, or the book this is based on, that cat thing happens in like that. The cat disappears and doesn't come back, so in the book, the character's wife says, oh, go through the machine again, it'll turn you human. So he goes through the machine again, but now the disappearing cat atoms reappear. So he comes out of the machine as a fly and cat monster in the book, and that's when they... And so in the book, she's like, I'm going to crush your head in a fucking hydraulic press.
Does happen in the movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, that scene with the cat in the original Fly, that is a upsetting scene for something made in 1958.
Yeah.
Just the fact that
the cat ghost?
Yeah, the cat ghost. Okay.
That was the original title of the film, I think, too.
Cat ghost dad. But... Yeah, that scene always bothered me.
Right.
They get Swayze to play the cat.
Yeah.
Interesting. I don't think he was even born.
We'll never know. There's no way to look that up.
We'll never know.
There's no way to look that up, so we'll never know. But anyway, after...
That 58 movie, like, I watched, like, the first half hour of it.
Yeah. It's good. I love that movie.
I haven't seen it since I was a kid, so...
It felt like a Wes Anderson movie, like, as I was watching it.
That's because the gender politics of the time are crazy, almost like Wes Anderson would be lampooning it. But
yeah.
This is...
it was just, like, similar zooms, like...
Well, all right, you're talking about the filmmaking itself.
Yeah.
The
style.
Okay.
All right, so where are we going with that?
Oh, so we're talking about the brunch sex session.
Okay,
so after
that
happens, he's like... Let's go. You got to go through the machine.
Your turn.
We got to be the dynamic duo.
Bring your lace doily panties and get in the machine with me.
He's trying to start the best tag team ever for WWE.
And she's like, fuck, no, I'm not doing that. And then so Gina Davis shows up and she utters the famous the famous be afraid, be very afraid line, which after this film sort of just became part of like the lexicon of just
Right, and you probably don't even know that it comes from this film. You just know the line.
That was even like the tagline for this film, and it came from this movie.
It was originally "Be fly, be very a fly."
Yeah, it was.
That's interesting that they would write that. And say, this sounds good.
Well, that was the original draft, and they fired that guy.
And then it was "In space, no one can hear you fly."
Right. Yeah. All these are accurate.
That sounds great, Dave.
Like Videodrome, this film also has pieces of dialogue that are fantastic but shouldn't be.
I have the opposite opinion.
Do you?
Yeah, I have that in my notes.
Give
actually
it to me.
So yeah, like Videodrome, there's a lot of mention of the flesh, which is Cronenberg's favorite word.
Right. And
that and motorcycle.
And I feel like unlike Videodrome, where the dialogue shouldn't have worked but it worked, I feel like a lot of that dialogue shouldn't have worked and didn't work in this.
I didn't like the where he's like, "Taste of the plasma spring." I was
exactly.
like, that's dumb.
Exactly.
But at the same
exactly
time,
that.
At the same time, I think it works because in Videodrome, when the characters are saying lines like that, you're supposed to accept it. Whereas in this, you're supposed to be like, he's fucking going crazy. So maybe that's why he's babbling
it was
about
just,
this.
It was very hard for me to swallow those types of pieces of dialogue. I don't know if it's because Goldblum is so erratic as he's saying it that it made it hard to believe, and James Woods is so, you know,
woodsy,
reserved. Yeah, he's very woodsy.
He's very outdoorsy.
He's an outdoorsman. He's whittling. Fashioning a kayak out of a log. It's wonderful.
Enough about the James Woods.
Oh, all right.
What was that?
I don't know.
Erase that.
There was one. I'm trying to think. Like there were some good dialogue in there, though. The one scene where he's like, "I'm an insect who used to be a man."
No, that worked. But
that whole insect politics speech was very.
It's like so creepy.
Yeah,
and that worked. But I was thinking more along the lines of what Chris was saying when Brundle is still Brundle.
Yeah, he hasn't gone. He hasn't gone full walrus.
He's saying this nonsense techno babble, which is. It's just theorizing these bizarre things that nobody in their right mind would say. And I know he's not in his right mind. I just didn't buy it. It was hard for me to
take. The one time I didn't buy it was when Gina Davis says it, because it doesn't make sense for her to... Like, there's a scene where they're making out, and she's just like, "Oh, I love the flesh." And it's like, that sounds weird coming from you right now, because you're not supposed to be a lunatic.
And like you said...
She's the flesh drives me crazy.
She's like old women with babies.
They just keep saying flesh over and over
again. Cronenberg loves it, which it's a great word, because it's just hearing it is unsettling. Because if you just say skin, it's
whatever.
What's
a disgusting word?
Jeff's right, though. It does
Jeff's always right. What are we talking about?
They fucking say flesh so many times that it starts to annoy you.
Yeah. No, I
agree. In Videodrome where, you know...
It fits a little bit more, right? Yeah. It's like a mantra in Videodrome.
Right. That makes sense. Right. Whereas this is supposed to be dialogue between two people that's supposed to come off as natural, and it does not. Yeah. But we're nitpicking.
Maybe that's how David Cronenberg just talks to his wife all the time. Because they're just weirdos.
I don't know. I'm not crazy about the character Brundle.
Really? Yeah. Oh, I think he was great.
I like the character. I do like the character.
I love that he's so he's quirky and he's eccentric and he's likable, so that when he starts changing, it's almost like gut-wrenching, because it's like, oh, he's turning into this
tragic
asshole, and he's also dying.
What about Brundle don't you like?
It's weird, because he doesn't...
Are you sure you're not thinking of Grundlefly, the Reddit screen name?
Or Grendel, the creature from Beowulf?
Angelina Jolie.
Yeah.
What a great film. We're going to get to that one.
Okay, so initially she's not interested in him. And then within a day...
Well, he has the cappuccino maker.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And the two
Dave,
pods.
Did you see those tidy whities he was wearing?
But within
Who
a day, she's climbing into that fucking shitty sofa bed with
Well, I mean, you also have to think of it as he's
time's passing. I don't know if that was a day.
Yeah, and it's also he's a brilliant scientist,
she writes for a science magazine, so she's no dummy.
Magazine. And earlier in the film, she mentions she has a major in science, so she's sort of attracted to science and stuff that. So who wouldn't melt a little bit when a handsome telepod man shows up?
But even he's
Jeff Goldblum's a good looking guy. I mean, he's weird, but he's a good looking guy.
Now he is.
You don't think he was good looking then?
He's strange looking.
He's strange looking, but it's not an unattractive strange.
Yeah, no, I agree with Chris.
We both want to bang Jeff Goldblum.
We would love to triple kiss Jeff Goldblum.
All right, well, I guess I do love Brundle then.
Compared to Videodrome, how do you rank the fly? Is it better, worse, about the same?
I love the fly, and I would say better.
Really?
A better movie.
You think the fly is better or Videodrome is better?
Oh, The Fly.
Okay.
I think Videodrome is better.
I think The Fly is more accessible. I think Videodrome is probably his Cronenberg's best movie, but this movie, I would say, is like a close set. This is a great movie.
This is an excellent movie, like, and I was wrestling with which is better and why.
Right.
And I think just Videodrome has a lot of theorizing that it forces the audience to do. You have to think about things and think about this world, whereas The Fly is very character-driven.
Right. Like we were saying, like, last week we had a little difficulty talking about Videodrome because it's a very, like, visceral and cerebral movie.
Yeah.
Whereas it's a little easier to talk about The Fly because even though it does have those...
It's a three-man show.
Right, yeah.
But The Fly will always have that, like, nostalgia to it. You know what I mean? It fits in with those Halloween movies almost.
Yeah,
you
well, this is true horror. Whereas Videodrome, there's horror in it.
Right.
It's more of, like you said, a cerebral
right.
Sci-fi drama. This is pure horror.
This is a horror movie.
This is body horror taken to the next level.
Yeah, this is, like, the ultimate in body horror. And, I don't know, going back to, like, why I think Brundle is likable is because I think, like, the ending is devastating.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Even after everything he's done and become, even after trying to basically, like, kill Gina Davis in the pod, when he crawls out and he's just, like, this pitiful monster and he just asks her to kill him, it's like, this is depressing. Like, you feel bad because, like, you obviously he needs to be killed at this point because what the fuck? And he's not going to have any life
for
him.
For the second time now, we're ending a Cronenberg movie with a gun to the head.
Right. And
with somebody pulls the trigger.
And it's, like, it's sort of different because, like, with Videodrome, I, even though I love James Woods in that movie, I never really felt
connected.
Sorry.
But yeah, there's no empathy for that character.
Like, yeah, when James Woods ends Videodrome by killing himself, I'm not, like, good, but I'm also not, like, oh, I feel really bad. Yeah. Whereas with The Fly, with Brundle, it's like, I really wish this hadn't happened to this guy. I feel really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just think it's the narrative form of The Fly that makes it better than Videodrome. Like, you're more...
It's more of a standard
invested
narrative.
In the journey.
It's easier to get through. I mean,
absolutely easier.
So, of all the constant gross scenes in this film, if you each had to pick the most disturbing scene to you, what would you pick?
Oh, wow.
When the tooth falling onto the keyboard is mine. It really...
You gotta think, like, about teeth falling out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's always a nightmare.
And just his reaction to it, like, ooh. Like, a tooth fell out.
I love that, like, at first he's horrified with his body horror, but, like, I love, like, as the film gets nearer the end, he's like that scene you mentioned where he's on the wall, he's like, look at this, what's this? I don't know. He's, like, just embracing it.
He's got a giant tumor on his stomach.
I think for me, it's when he's in one of his transformations towards the end where he's still visibly Jeff Goldblum and he's kind of hunched over and talking to Gina Davis and he's doing, like, twitches and he's got those tics going on with his eyes and he's looking inside. And he's losing it. He's got so much hair missing.
Yeah.
Just patches of it.
That's the one that bothers me the most because he's still a man and it just looks like he's in agony. And it's something about that bothers. I don't know if it's the humanity
when he
kinda
comes
of it.
Over with the cane, that grosses me out, too.
Yeah, he has, like, the two canes.
He's on two canes, and it's just, it's horrifying.
If I had to pick, it wouldn't even be a Brundle scene. It's that dream sequence where Gina Davis gives birth to a maggot, which is just...
Just a larva.
It's just endlessly... I think birth in general, even when it's not in a horror movie, is just a little creepy to begin with. Because when you think about, like, every detail about pregnancy and birth, it's just like, oh, I get a little uncomfortable with this because I'm a guy. But
prove it.
Get it on the table.
Later. But just that scene, and it almost doesn't count because it's a dream, but just that the way it's done, because, like, the dream is she's having an abortion, and the doctor's like, oh, there's still something in there. And he's like, all right, I need you to push. And the way they shoot this scene, because, like, you don't see what it is at first, and, like...
There's blood everywhere.
And, like, the one nurse, like, looks away, and she's heart-screaming, and, like, she's like... And Gina Davis looks up, and she's like, what is it? And she sees, like, the maggot.
It's a giant maggot.
And David Cronenberg...
Just David Cronenberg holding
and
it.
And what I love about this scene is, as the doctor character, Cronenberg is still being a professional doctor, because he's not, like, throwing it in disgust. What I love about it is...
He's not spraying Raid on it.
he's hauling it, but he looks away. And even though he's wearing a mask, you can see him like wince, but he's also still holding it because he's like, I'm a doctor. I got to show her baby. So just that, and just
it's you want to cut the cord?
It's just an upsetting scene. And then she wakes up and she's like just in bed. And it's just like, ah, that's terrible.
Oh, there's a cut scene.
Oh, just one second. I mistakenly.
A video game cut scene where.
Yeah.
I mistakenly said that that could have been an homage to Dead Ringers, which didn't come out until after The Fly.
Oh,
so.
Well, then you were dead wrong.
Dead Wrongers. Am I right, everybody?
Dead Wrongers, the Dave Costell story. Good night, everyone.
So the. Are you talking about the butterfly scene?
Yeah, I don't understand that. There's a cut scene.
And I'm glad it's cut. This was the original ending of the film, right?
I'm assuming this is meant to be a dream, but Gina Davis is dreaming about her embryo, Brundle baby. Yeah, her Brundle baby that's still inside her, and it turns into a fly, a fetus with wings and flies away into the...
It's meant to be like a happy ending somehow.
I don't know what it's meant to be.
They actually...
Completely nonsensical.
They shot like several endings and they didn't use any of them because they realized like we don't need it. And they also were saying like test audiences were just so stunned from Jeff Goldblum getting his head blown off. They were like, we don't need anything else.
Yeah.
But there was one ending with the butterfly wings. There was one ending where Gina Davis wakes up in bed and she's not pregnant, and Stannis Baratheon says, he goes, oh, there is no baby, which is just weird, because it's like, what, it was the whole movie a fucking dream? Why is this happening?
But I love it when movies do that.
That would suck up for this movie. And
I'm
then,
kidding, I hate that.
And then there was they shot one ending where she wakes up in bed alone, and she's still clearly pregnant. Then they shot another ending where she wakes up in bed, and she has nothing in her stomach, so you're like, oh, did she give birth or not? Mm. And the answer is yes, because we got a sequel.
Yeah.
Where
did we ever?
Where Brundle's son was played by Eric Stoltz.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never seen the sequel.
It's not good.
No reason to.
The only character who's still in it is Stannis Baratheon, but he's, you know.
He needed to work.
Yeah.
I tease this the whole fucking time, but the Howard Shore, it just was like a little too softcore porny in the early scenes.
I really liked it. I loved the score.
Very and Kenny G. Like.
Howard Shore. Well, Kenny G was big in the early 90s, yeah. So who knows. Howard Shore does, we said this last time, but he does a lot of Cronenberg movies. And this,
all of them, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
More or less. Not
this yet. This whole thing is definitely an homage to the original score of the 1958 Fly.
Is it?
Yeah.
See, that might have been my issue.
I played them side by side earlier today just to make sure that was true, and it is.
And you put the Pink Floyd on at the same time?
Well, yeah.
And Wizard of Oz. And
then I played two Nickelback songs at the same time, and I said, oh man, these guys really do stink. But yeah, this is definitely an homage to the original score. It's not identical. Because I thought that when I was watching this movie. I was like, wow, that sounds really old. I bet it's the same score. It's not. But it plays a lot of the same type of beats. It's the same tempo as the original score. And it's a lot of the same instruments. It's very good. It's intentionally softcore porny.
Oh, we should okay. We should have had that for Soundtrack Sunday, which we didn't do today.
Well, we were all sleeping in.
I'll say I appreciate it more then because of that. That's actually pretty damn interesting.
Yeah, just for fun. After you're done listening to this episode, why don't you play both scores?
Also
somehow?
For fun, why don't you give us a review on iTunes?
Yes. And for fun, why don't you play with a loaded gun?
All three of those things are equal amounts of fun.
Do we have any closing words on The Fly?
It's a great movie. Like I said, I don't know if it's as good as Videodrome. I don't think it is, personally.
Yeah.
But absolutely, if you've never seen this, get...
Yeah, what
your
the
ass
you're an
to
idiot.
The internet and rent this on iTunes.
Yeah. What I love about it is even though this is Cronenberg's most popular movie and his most mainstream movie, I love that it's not a mainstream movie in the way you think of it. Like, it would have been very easy for Cronenberg to just make an easy Hollywood movie and make money so he can make his own sort of thing. And he didn't do that with this. This is still feels... Thank you. Oh, I got an email. Sorry. This still feels like a Cronenberg movie, even though it's, you know, as I guess Hollywood as you can get with Cronenberg. It still feels like a Cronenberg movie.
What I like about it is they took the central premise of the original story and then made their own vision out
which
of
is
it.
Like the best kind of way to do a remake. There's nothing worse than just a remake that's just
Psycho.
Exactly. Yeah.
Gus Van Sant's
that's
Psycho.
Exactly like the original because it's like, why don't I just watch the original? Like,
yeah.
This film was from an era when they got remakes right, because, like, The Thing remake is the same sort of thing where it's the similar story, but they do their own thing. And even like the Invasion of the Body Snatchers remake, same sort of thing, its own sort of movie.
Right.
It's cool because it's not, you're saying it's not traditionally a mainstream movie,
right,
but it's like the mainstream adjusted to Cronenberg sensibilities.
Yeah.
And that's what's cool about it, is that this marks a time and where we're like, we want more. It's like drive-in movie theater gore,
right,
like this.
Right.
But done well. Yeah. Not like
it's not like, it's not trashy. It's like it's a movie with actual like intellectual thought behind it. It's not just like, look at this gore.
And heart.
Yeah.
Because you do care about Brundle.
Yeah.
And even in the end, even though Stathis Barrand is a reprehensible character,
right,
there's still qualities to, like, he saves Veronica.
Like, he steps up at the end. Like, not even just like the ending scene, just in general, because like she goes to him when she's pregnant and stuff like that.
Yeah. I want a sequel of handless, footless him making a shitload of money off of the transporters. That's all it is.
He stole Brundle's idea.
Would be wonderful.
He's just fucking loaded. King of the universe. Stan Baratheon or whatever his name is.
All right,
cool.
Do some recommendations?
Yeah.
Boy, that doesn't get any better than that.
Love that hard ending, too. It just cuts off.
Who's going first, folks?
Now, if that was me, I would have done it again.
Yeah. Just ignore me.
Oh, sorry.
Nah, Dave, you go first. You go first.
You want me to go first?
Yeah, I want you to go first.
We should flip a coin, a three-sided coin.
We don't have any Russian currency.
I have this three-sided die, all that.
As I said earlier in this episode, I will be recommending The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, Them. Which, unless you live in New York, you can't see until Friday.
La-di-da.
All right, so what's the backstory on this
movie? Okay.
Because it's crazy.
So Ned Benson, the director, filmed
what
two...
What about Ben Nenson? All right, go on, continue. Dave?
Was that an elephant?
It was. That was a fly.
You'll never forget.
Brundle elephant. Anyway... he filmed two separate movies, The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, Him, and then The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, Her.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's called Him, right? Yeah. Him.
It was called
Her.
Shim, I believe.
That's
very insensitive. Very insensitive.
Yeah. It's the very rude.
It's a fucking podcast, man.
We get to the end, we just fall apart.
Anyway... So each film was 95 minutes long, combined for a nice 3-hour and 10-minute block.
Who doesn't love 3 hours and 10 minutes of movie?
And these are actually being released, I learned, in limited markets. I didn't realize
the individual
that.
Ones.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
But I won't get to see them until they're out on DVD or something.
Die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
but anyway, Ned Benson or whatever his name is.
Ned Beatty.
Ben Nenson. I don't. You confused me. I really don't remember.
Not a lot of directors named Ned. So no.
Uncle Ben's rice box.
It feels wrong. He combined them into a single film that kind of explores the deterioration of this relationship after this insane tragic event in their lives. But Jessica Chastain and James McAvoy play the two characters. Eleanor. Her name's actually Eleanor Rigby. Which
her
is kind of like
funny.
They're hippies, so I was like, they need me.
I like both those actors.
Oh, Jessica Chastain's fucking amazing.
I love
this.
Her. She is great.
I mean, she's great in everything, but this is cool because, and I would imagine that her version is amazing because.
Oh, where she gets that new iOS that talks to her.
It helps her kill Bin Laden.
What? Zero Dark 30.
Yeah. We're just doing movie references.
Zero
now.
Dark Her.
I'm trying to get through this, people.
Dave, continue.
Please, don't let us stop you.
Because it spends, the whole thing is with her, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's awesome.
Is she a more interesting character?
Yes.
It sounds like it.
James McAvoy, you feel for him, but his movie feels a little like... New York City guys palling around-y, you know what I mean?
Good.
It doesn't
have Entourage the movie? What's Turtle doing?
I wouldn't say it's that bad, but it's like, it's just not as weighty as Jessica Chastain's version. Okay. And that creates a huge issue when you're putting the two films together because it's schizophrenic. It keeps shifting tone.
Does it feel like two movies crammed together?
Because that's
that sort of like turns me off on it. Like it did feel like I'm worried it'll seem.
If you see, that's what's bugging me about a lot of the critics' reviews of it is that they're all basing their opinions on that. But if you didn't know that, it would feel like, you know, that these choices were made naturally. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that the tonal shift is intentional. Because it does, it works, and it's jarring at places, but that creates like a unique movie going experience.
Okay,
it's very cool.
And when's
I liked
that come
it.
Out?
Friday.
Okay,
in theaters this Friday. Go check your local cinema times on moviephone.com.
That's the disappearance of Eleanor Rigby.
Yeah.
Okay. Who's up next?
Whoa. Well, just a solid block of sound on the on the time code thing.
I'll go, I guess.
Yeah, please do after that.
All right. Sorry, everybody. I got a little excited with Aerosmith and Steven Tyler. My recommendation is a 1966 film called Seconds. It's directed by John Frankenheimer.
I've always wanted to see this.
It's fantastic. Yeah. It's John Frankenheimer did the Manchurian Candidate, the original one.
Yes.
Not the Denzel Washington one.
No.
And he also did Black Sunday.
And
unfortunately, he did Reindeer Games.
Yes. He also did Ronin, which is like a really good movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Most recently, if you're going to watch one of his recent films, watch Ronin instead of Reindeer Games.
I think Reindeer Games is like his last movie, which is depressing because he passed away.
It stars Rock Hudson, John Randolph, and Salome Jens. And it's about an unhappy middle-aged banker who agrees to undergo a procedure that will fake his death and give him a completely new look and identity, but it comes with a price.
And doesn't everything.
The price is definitely interesting.
$20.
Yes, it's.
And he's like, I don't know if I can swing that.
But that's $20 1966 money.
Yeah, which
that's
like $30.
$40 now.
You gonna tell us the twist?
No.
Ugh.
No, this is much like No Good Deed. I can't. I can't.
Please do not spoil the
twist
shocking
slip.
Twist.
So yeah, this is a great, great movie. Rock Hudson's fantastic in this. If you like Rock Hudson. And John Randolph is no
I like Rock Quarry.
Oh, all right.
The Flintstones actor.
Interesting. Well, he was played by Rock Hudson.
Yeah.
In case you didn't know that, he was voiced by Rock Hudson. Rock Quarry was. John Randolph is great in it. He plays the character before he turns into Rock Hudson when he goes under the... But it's mostly Rock Hudson's
show.
Oh,
so it's like Face Off.
Yeah, except good.
Hey now. Don't get me started on defending Face Off, because I will.
It's a creepy movie. The cinematography is unparalleled, especially for 1966.
James Wong Howe?
Yes. And he did it. It's very unique in what he did. There's a great scene where people are squashing grapes naked in a giant tub.
Nice.
It's like this weird hippie orgy that happens, and there's full frontal nudity, and it's wonderful.
Right, let me pull this up.
Yeah, and pull something else up, too. It's a fantastic movie. I don't know if it's on Hulu Plus, but it is available on DVD through Criterion.
Yeah, I've always wanted to watch this.
Watch it, because if you like The Twilight Zone especially, watch it. The first 15 minutes of it, there's almost no dialogue. It's just creepy shots.
Talk in my language.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's like every Thanksgiving dinner I've ever been at.
Did you pick this because of its direct relations with The Fly?
No.
The body transformia?
Nope. I just heard somebody talking about this movie on another podcast, and I thought,
why are you listening to other podcasts?
Because I like watching movies, and I like hearing about movies I've never heard of before. So watch Seconds. It's on Criterion, directed by the great John Frankenheimer. Or John Frankensteiner.
Yeah, whatever you want.
James Franco's remaking this.
Or Scott Steiner. It was directed by Scott Steiner. Chris?
How does that film compare to Gone in 60 Seconds, its sequel?
Gone in 60 Seconds pales in comparison to most movies.
You can't just follow it up.
No.
30 Seconds to Mars.
Oh, boy. Put on all their albums at once, please.
My pick is 1963's Charade.
Oh.
So,
two 60s buddies here.
Yeah, we love the 60s.
What the fuck, guys? You could have told me it was 60 Saturday.
Even though it's Sunday. So, I haven't really seen a lot of Audrey Hepburn movies. Like, I've seen Breakfast at Tiffany's. Yeah. So,
While, I love Audrey Hepburn.
So yeah, I was sort of like, I don't know what I'm missing with Audrey Hepburn. So I there's a bunch of Audrey Hepburn movies on Netflix. So I watched a few. I watched Roman Holiday, which was her debut, which is great. And I also watched Charade, which is fantastic. So in Charade, Audrey Hepburn, she plays a woman. She's married to a very rich man, and she's sort of bored in her marriage. She doesn't really get along with her husband. So she decides she's going to divorce him. But before she can divorce him, he turns up dead. And apparently, before he died, he stole a lot of money. So the government, and the government in this film is represented by Walter Matthau. And Walter Matthau...
Back when he was doing dramas. And,
yeah. So Walter Matthau in this film, he's younger, and by that I mean he looks exactly the same he looked right before he died.
He looked like a shoe falling apart.
Walter Matthau was eternally old. So Walter Matthau plays a government agent who's trying to get the money, but also there's a bunch of men from her husband's past who show up, and they all have weird eccentricities. Like, one has like a hook for a hand. And one of them is like this generic southern guy who's named Tex. He's played by James Coburn, who was a great character actor. And one of them is like this older guy who sneezes all the time. What? So they're all trying to get their money back. But
which one is bashful?
They're all trying to get their money back. But also, she runs into a guy played by Cary Grant, who is at his most charming in this film.
Does he have his tiny mustache?
No.
Pencil mustache?
No, he doesn't have that in this. So Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn, they're basically running around Paris trying to both find the missing money and elude these three murderous henchmen. And even though it's a movie with murder in it, it's just endlessly funny. It's like a dark comedy.
This is a comedy then.
It is. And it's very funny. And one of the most interesting things about the movie is Cary Grant was a lot older than Audrey Hepburn when they made this film, and he was hesitant to take the role because of that, because he's supposed to be wooing her character. Mm-hmm. And so in order to basically convince him, the screenwriter, Peter Stone, he switched the character so that all of Cary Grant's character traits were switched to Audrey Hepburn's. So instead of being a movie about a guy chasing this younger woman, it's about her chasing him.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And it's actually really amusing because she's just like this sex-crazed woman trying to get into Cary Grant's pants, basically.
That's cool.
And the movie, there's like a twist every like 10 minutes in this movie. And it's always
boy,
like...
Boy, do I love a good twist.
And it's always like, I can't believe this is happening. Ow. And it's just, it's a silly...
Do they actually do the twist?
They do. Chubby Checker shows up.
I wish I could twist your head off for that.
That's a logical reaction to that joke. So, but it's just, it's a lot of fun. Audrey Hepburn is great in this, as she was in most things I've come to learn. And
she was delightful.
Yeah, I would, because of the way the studio system was set up back then, it's tough for the director series to explore, like, you know, like an actress.
Because every studio kind of had the same movie.
Right.
And the same themes over and over.
Yeah.
And
so it'd be cool to like do like Audrey Hepburn, like a series
of
films. Yeah.
I agree. We should do that sometime.
And Charade, it's almost like a Hitchcock movie, so much so that a lot of people think this is a Hitchcock movie. Like, some people call this like the greatest Hitchcock movie Hitchcock never made.
Oh, all right.
Because it's got that sort of like, because Cary Grant is in it, and it's got that sort of like European feel to it, and it's a mystery.
Nice.
And it was directed by Stanley Donen, and it was 1963's Charade, or Charade, if you will.
I won't. And with that, we have to wrap it up.
We have to end this charade that we give a shit.
Pretend that we had a good show. Tell each other this was great. I'm just kidding. It was wonderful. You two are lovely gentlemen.
Oh, you're so sweet, Jeff.
I am. Get off me.
With your little chubby cheeks. So if you were enjoying the Cronenberg series, you won't next week.
Next week, we have a hammering blow to you.
Yes.
When we talk about what year did this come out? 1999's Existenz.
Right, we could have done any of his other good movies.
No, but it was my turn to pick a movie, and I picked Existenz.
Jeff loves misery, so.
Which,
you never know. When I saw Existenz many moons ago, I liked it, so it might not be that bad.
Yeah. I picked it because I never saw it, and I thought, well, if we don't watch this now, I will never watch this movie, probably, so
but
why not?
That might have been a good thing, though.
Well, it's the only movie between Videodrome and Existenz that Cronenberg wrote and directed fully without the help of anyone else. And apparently they explore very similar themes. So.
Right. Well, that's another reason I paid.
It's kind of like, it's like Videodrome for video games, if you will.
And probably not very good.
No.
But
and Lana Del Rey's song Video Games plays for the whole movie.
That's impossible.
I don't know how he did it.
Not to judge a book by its cover. This might end up being good, but it won't.
Or judge a cover by its book, that's for right. that matter.
I don't understand how you would do that.
Woo, yeah! It's over.
So, yeah. Also, you know, like we said earlier, check out our site,
cutprintfilm.com.
Give us a fantastic review on iTunes.
You
if
won't,
you will.
But you should.
I know, you won't do that either.
Why would you, you scumbags?
That's an odd way to talk to the audience.
And you should also check out some other shows, right?
Yes, like Cut Print Film Podcast.
Yes.
The very show you just listened to.
And there's some other stuff, too, I guess.
Joystick Jerks.
Right.
Yes.
The podcast.
That's right. At joystickjerks.com. Also, who else?
I don't know. Who else?
Anti-Funboy at right. antifanboy.com.
It's interesting that their name is different than the URL.
I don't know. It's a thing. I don't know.
It seems counterintuitive, but I don't know.
And go to morelikeradio.com to check us out and more other podcasts.
215 other podcasts.
Yeah, click through that massive slider and pick which one is your favorite.
Oh, come on, Curtis Mayfield. Don't start vacuuming yet. We're not done.
I don't know why he's vacuuming the ceiling. He's very strong.
He doesn't know what he's doing.
He's super fly, that's why.
I guess Loja didn't leave him good notes.
Notes! Good night.